history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really need to be told, and we'll never hear them unless we take a little time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're coming up on the 78th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and we have the privilege of meeting a Pearl Harbor survivor today in Porterville, California, home for the last 73 years to Chuck Keene, 97 years old, 97 and a half, I guess I should say. But you didn't grow up in California. You're from Burley, Idaho. Where is that, and how big is it?
Well, it's about 5,000 people, and it's about 200 miles north of Salt Lake City on the Snake River in southern Idaho.
So what was that childhood like in Burley, Idaho?
There's 9 members of the family, and my dad was an optometrist. We planted gardens and took care of rent house. We had several rental houses, and we spent all of our time taking care of work. And a lot that I learned at home was I used in later life, like plumbing and electrical work and start of it, I learned before I ever went into service.
What was the toughest chore you had as a kid?
Getting along with my oldest brother, which I couldn't do. When I got ready to go into service, I had to get away from there because I felt like I was being strangled by my family. And I guess a lot of guys feel that when they're 60 or 70 years old. And I wanted to join the Navy, and my dad wouldn't let me go. And so I thought I'd go to the Royal Canadian Air Force. And they threw a roadblock in that, so I went back to my mother, and she says, well, if your older brother says you can go, I guess it'll be all right. And so the chief took me down there to see my older brother. He was a deputy coroner. Walked in and he said, Mr. Keene, you understand your brother can join the service if it's up to you. And he says, yeah, you might as well. He's no damn good around here. That's what he said.
And did it stay that way with you and your brother?
It stayed that way until after the war, and I finally decided, family feud, all of the death and everything that I saw, I wanted to make up with him, and I decided I'd go over to his house, and none of the family wanted me to go see him, but I thought I would go. I told him, I just want to treat you like a brother, and that we can just be two human beings doing our own thing, and he just broke down and cried like a baby, and then we were good friends for the last year. He lived about a year and a half. He wrote me and sent me stuff for helpful for my health and all kinds of things. So it was rewarding.
Well, and I'm always curious too, because the war changed so many lives. I mean, it changed all of our lives if we're looking closely enough at it. But were there some ideas or ambitions you had before you decided to join the Navy that you thought, hey, someday I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
Yes, I wanted to be an electrical engineer or a guy in forestry is what my dad wanted me to be. He offered me money for that, but my brothers just could not believe that he was going to give me money and wouldn't give them money to go to college. It was such a mess that I told him, no, I'm going to go in the Navy. And I turned him down. But I wanted to go into the Forest Service building in some capacity.
And so I'm clear, when you say you decided to go in the Navy instead, was that because you knew the Navy would help you pay for college if you went in the service?
No, not really. I went into the service because the war was just starting over in France. The war started, and the guys were flying planes and everything like that. And I just like a Miller to the fire, I wanted to go see what was happening. I wanted to be part of it, and the Navy was the quickest way to get there.
And since you mentioned how big your family was, I'm curious how many of your siblings also ended up serving in World War II?
Just two, both in the Army and not for a very long time. One, then my youngest brother, went into the Air Force after I got out. See, I was in the war for 6 years, and all of my family was growing up. The kids, all the younger, had 6 years of growth, and I never even knew them, really. When I come home, they were strangers to me. My older brother, he got what I would always call, to me, I felt bad about it. My dad got him off to help with the office that he needed him at home to get him out of the service. And he knew the senator from Idaho, and so it was a political-like thing to me that they didn't get out. So I wasn't proud of that.
So you joined the Navy in February 1941. Did you expect America to be at war soon?
Yes. Yeah, I thought we already were at war, just didn't know it.
What were those first few months in the Navy like for you? What did they do with you?
Like a little kid with a new toy, really. Number one, I could smoke if I wanted to smoke. My mother wouldn't get after me for cussing. And little things like that. But very short order, you see, I went in February, and in December we were at war. From June on, we were preparing for war real fast, getting the ship stripped down and, you know, all of the bric-a-brac on the ship off, you know, the ceremonial stuff, getting rid of that so we could go to sea. We shipped out in September of 41, and we just barely got in there and got aboard ship. The Honolulu. I went out on a destroyer and went aboard the Honolulu in Pearl Harbor.
And what was Pearl Harbor, or just Oahu in general, what was the life like there in the weeks or months leading up to December 7th?
It was a good life because I'm not like the normal guy. I liked the libraries and I liked to go visit. I really did. I got a big kick out of reading and going around and looking at how the pineapple grew, and it was just like a new experience, like I was in a new land, and it was different from anything that I'd seen in Idaho.
And what were your duties aboard the Honolulu?
Supposed to be an electrician. I passed Class A school and to do the wiring and put the fuses and stuff in box. We had, when it first started, you just had simple things to do, but eventually when the war started, all of the little treats and things that were on there were all gone. Everything was necessary, and you had better take care of it the best you could. I used my training from Class A electrical school, and it helped me a lot on there because I was quite a bit ahead of some of the other kids that come in because they knew nothing about it.
And so you would have been 19 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. I want to hear about the morning of December 7th, but I'm curious, do you remember anything about the night before, Saturday night, December 6th?
Yeah, I was down and getting ready to do my first night of mess cooking aboard ship. At that time, everybody had to do 6 weeks of mess cooking, and that was the old chief cook was showing us all the things that we had to do, how to fix the trays. I was going to put the trays and wash. After the guys had eaten, I washed the trays and put them in a rack. That was going to be my job when I got up the next morning, and that's what I got up to. Is we no more started breakfast than the general quarters alarm rang. I ran topside, and here was a Japanese Zero coming right down the dock, just strafing the hell out of things. You know, we didn't know, had never had any training on being under gunfire. I compare it to pulling a little spool in the dirt, running along behind and seeing the dust come up behind the spool in the alleyway. Well, that's the way those bullets were coming down that. And we never had brain wanted to duck or anything like that. We just watched it go by. Everybody was just sort of in awe because we'd never seen a plane like that. Every plane that they showed us had two wings and big propellers.
So, yeah, I mean, clearly this was shocking. This was unexpected. So what did you do when you came topside and you saw all that? What did you do with yourself?
Well, my buddy Freeberg from Seattle, we were topside searchlights, big searchlights. We had to man those searchlights. Well, it seemed sort of dumb to do anything with a searchlight in broad daylight. So we were down helping wherever we could, and I was helping try to get ammunition to these 3-inch guns because they had no provisions for that. They had a locker full of them, and so we'd throw the locker open and try to keep shells enough for the guns, and then the gun got hot and it jammed, and we just had all kinds of problems. Then you'd go to the next one. We just sort of all over the ship the first day until we were hit. They come by, they dropped a bomb, and it hit the dock and exploded underneath the ship and caved our whole front of the ship in, the 500-pound bomb, and so we couldn't go anywhere because our magazine had collapsed, and they were afraid it was going to blow up. And so the next 3 days, I spent myself down in my shorts and skivvies, you would say, and with stockings, and going down there sweeping up gunpowder with a foxtail and by the pail to get it out of there to where it's a miracle we didn't blow up right then, you know, but the only thing that they said that saved us was it collapsed the peak tanks where the water was. It forced the water right back into the magazine, and so it didn't explode. That's why I'm still here, is because if that had gone off, we'd all been gone. But
well, and I know there are a couple other moments throughout the war where you might not have been here if it didn't go a certain way. But I'm wondering, while you're doing all this and this is happening, while you realize your ship is under attack, did you ever have a chance to look out and see what else was happening throughout Pearl Harbor?
They flew right by our fantail, the torpedo bombers that were torpedoing the battleships, come right by. They swooped down into the water just in back of our ship and launched their torpedoes for the battleships. We had what they call a blister. Those torpedoes didn't do much damage to the ship because they put it right in 39 or somewhere along there. They put what they call 6-inch blisters on the battleship, so they had to make it so the torpedoes wouldn't hit them. They pretty well sheltered it off, but the ones that got all of it was the armor pierced, and they flew and they dropped the bombs down, and they come down through the deck that way and exploded. But the big explosion we heard was the Shaw and two ships in dry dock. They exploded, and that just like crushed me. It killed one guy on the dock, because you see the docks have a revetment alongside there that you can put stuff back in, that's cinder block or whatever it is like that, and all of your weapons and everything were stored back in that area. Well, this guy was standing in there, so when the blast that hit me went on through, it hit him, but it came off the back of that thing and he just crushed him. And that's the first time that I saw a guy just dead by explosion. I mean, it just killed him.
Well, and you said something about yourself feeling that too. So what did you feel? What did you experience?
My experience was just like somebody had grabbed me and just crushed my lungs. And I couldn't, for a minute, I didn't think I was ever going to really breathe again. It marked me so that even after the war, sudden sounds for a long time. They never had any therapy or any way to treat us for it, but if a sudden sound would shake and I'd be shaking inside. You know, I could hold my hands here, but it seemed like everything inside was jerking. It takes several hours for that to go away. I had that for years, you know, every sudden noises or something shake, but the big damage that I had was that explosion aboard that dry dock.
Well, that's one of the most captivating photos from Pearl Harbor, is the Shaw. Yeah. The concussion of that explosion smacked you in the chest.
Smashed me, yeah. It knocked me down. I couldn't stand. I mean, I went down. I didn't know what had happened to me. And then I got up. You can't imagine getting hit. Well, if you played football or something, you might, but it's not really as hard because it crushes you from both sides. You just feel like everything's coming out your mouth.
So again, this is a 19-year-old kid from Idaho who's been living in paradise, and now his world is turned upside down. And I was struck by something you wrote down for your family, a few memories, when you said, "We were attacked on December 7th, 1941 by the Japanese." You wrote, "Our fleet was destroyed, and so was my innocence." What did you mean by that?
Well, I'd never seen death before. I'd never seen that my kind of suffering. I never did, and never have since. The worst day of the war was the worst day of my life. It was awful. It all seemed like it all run together to the 11th, to December 11th. It seemed like there was no night or day. We were just trying to clean up, you know. We still had guys trapped underwater. We had guys trying to get out. We had a lot of 2,000 guys burned laying on the dock trying to take care of them. It was just a big mess till the 11th. Then we finally, they said, well, on the 11th, they came out and said, well, we're going to go back to San Francisco, because we didn't know how much damage it had on the ship, but it was extensive, and we had to go get it fixed. So that put us back in perspective, and it calmed down a little bit. We had some of our ships, planes trying to fly in from one of the other airports to fly in there, and our guys were so gun-shy, they were shooting at our own planes.
And you mentioned sweeping up the gunpowder to try to avoid a secondary explosion.
Yeah.
What else were you doing for those next few days after the attack?
Mostly repairing the bulkhead so the ship could get out. And believe it or not, we had to use timber. We had timber on there. I never dreamed that they'd have it on there, but we had 4x4s, 4x6, until we could block that side of the ship so if we got underway that it wouldn't cave in any more than where it was. So I was being carpenter for part of the time and tying things up. We tied everything up that we could and just got rid of all the junk on there, anything that we didn't need to go to war, you got rid of. You'd be surprised how much crap you'd get aboard a ship, you know, that you don't need.
And, you know, we know with the lens of history, we know that the Japanese came in two waves that day to Oahu, and they were also hitting other places like the Philippines and Clark Field. But you guys didn't know if they were coming back to Oahu again after December 7th. Was there a concern that more was coming in the days that followed?
They were sure that there's going to be carriers in there, and they never realized that he'd turned these carriers around and gone back to Japan. But according to the amount of fuel and weaponry and everything that we had on ours, we could figure they could have come right on in. So we were under alert entirely for the next, I guess they stayed on alert even after we got out of there. And they wanted everything that could move and get out because they figured another more attack.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to explore with 97-year-old Chuck Keene of Porterville, California. More from the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor, not to mention his close calls aboard the cruiser USS Honolulu, as well as the destroyer escort John C. Butler. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access so easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 97-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Chuck Keene of Porterville, California. The population there now is right around 60,000, and no doubt many families remember Chuck as their electrician. That's a profession his Navy service in World War II prepared him for. We're going to hear about his time at sea on the cruiser USS Honolulu and the destroyer escort USS John C. Butler. But since he's one of the last people alive to experience Imperial Japan's surprise attack on Oahu on December 7th, 1941, I'd like to explore a little more about the days and weeks that followed. I'm sure, Chuck, there've got to be things that you saw, you heard, you smelled, you experienced, things that are still very vivid nearly 78 years later.
One of the most vivid things is cutting the guy's mouth open to find how many teeth they had so they could identify them, but they didn't have an ID card or tag. The only way you could check them would be with their dental records. You just had to pry open a guy's mouth to count the teeth. That was horrible to me. I mean, I just, to this day, I've never got over that, but we had to do it. You had to find out who they were, and most of them, they successfully located a lot of them, but some they didn't, which, you know, there's 408, I think, of the ones that first day that they couldn't identify.
You got put on a detail to go bury some of them?
Yes, I was on a detail to bury them. I was also on the detail when we were identifying the ones that were seriously hurt. It's a crude thing that they said. I don't know whether you'd put it on there or not, but we had the whores to the women houses of ill fame or whatever it were. They put them all into service, you know, because they most new guys, they put them out on, brought them from Honolulu out there onto the island, and they were the ones that did most of the taking care of the guys that could be saved. But at the same time, there's one of them is rather crude. She says, go along and see the ones that had peed their pants. She said, any of them the ones that have pissed their pants are the ones that are hurt the worst. She was right. And one of them got almost through with that. And I said, why did she say that? She said, did you ever hear that it knocked the piss out of somebody? That's what they meant. That stuck with me. I learned from that you go down there and you see some guys wet his britches, why you're pretty well sure that he's hurt bad, and they were. Some of the hangars on the island were, we collected them, but they buried up above Honolulu, up there on the thing. I really have trouble with that because I was up there, but I couldn't tell anybody how you get up there to it, you know, but it was a hill.
It's the Punch Bowl crater, which is now an American cemetery. A lot of people go to the Arizona Memorial and everything that's around Pearl Harbor, but the Punch Bowl is one of the most moving places I've ever been.
That's where we put them in, and we never had identification for all of them, and on the ones that we didn't, they put their dental records, and keep in mind that it's 72 degrees, it's hot, and you know what happens to bodies when it gets warm, they go to swelling, and we had to get them buried. And so that shocked me that we couldn't do any more than what we did. We just took a string and tied it around their neck and put their ID up on the post. So, and that's the way but they were the lucky ones. They were the ones that could be identified. And some of them didn't, you know, we didn't know. And then others would put their dental record up there.
And the ones that weren't identified in recent years, there's been an exhumation, and they have gone back, and they've been able to identify quite a few of those sailors.
I'd sort of blocked that out of my mind. I knew they were doing it. They were covering guys up. That's what the way that it was told to me. A chief told me, he says, they're covering them up. And I knew that he meant they were just burying them.
Well, and you underscore the urgency of doing that for just physical reasons. But did it weigh on you at the time that those people, those victims of this attack, were not identified, and that their families would not have that final answer?
That didn't bother me. The thing that bothered me more than anything else is they gave me morphine, and for all of them that were crying or hollering, you know, for something, he just said, just give them a shot of morphine. Well, we were going along there, we were shoving morphine into those guys, and I thought I'd killed about 400, and I never knew until the nurse come here that I couldn't, you know, I had that on my mind for 60 years that I helped kill them, but they say I didn't, so I got some relief from that. But she said that if you put morphine into a muscle, it's not going to kill anybody, you know, what the dose that we give. But if it went into a vein or an artery, it could, but where you just put it in the arm, it didn't. It said you give them relief. And I know from being an explosion myself that morphine will certainly do away with pain right away. I myself screamed for it in an explosion aboard John C. Butler. I mean, one of the main connections exploded while I was trying to show the yard superintendent what was happening, and it just boom, it arced, and no fuse, no nothing. It's tied into the main energy on the dock. We just melted a hole, and we had a half-inch steel. Just melted down, and it knocked me out. I don't know what happened that I got out, but when I came to, I was in a van, and they had a pull motor on me. I think that's probably as close to dead as I've ever been, because I always remember just like circles of gray and just going back and forth, and all of a sudden I realized I'm moving, and they had me in an ambulance taking me to the Naval Hospital in Long Beach.
Well, and I want to come back to that with you, but sticking with the Pearl Harbor situation. So you're, you know, here you are 19 years old and you're having to care for the wounded and then to bury some of the dead, whether they can be identified or not. With that, now that more than 75 years later, they have been able, because of technology, to go back and identify some of them and give the families that closure. Does that mean anything to you to be aware of that?
Oh, yes. That means everything to me, that you, because the idea of knowing that someone is out, I have one that still bothers me because I know that they've never identified him. He was a pilot on an SOC, which the Honolulu had four planes, search observation craft on the back, and he lost track of us, and he was running out of gas, and he was the only one that I really knew on there. And he crashed that thing into the near Kodiak. He crashed it, and strange enough, almost 2 years later, they had the pontoon from that was aboard the Helena, I think, had it. It had the pontoon. It had numbers and said, this was from your plane. Well, nobody knew what happened to him. All we knew is what happened to the plane. Right. But I've always, you say, can you ever remember it? Yeah, I remember. I remember the last time I ever shook his hand.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, Morrison. He was an ensign. We didn't get really close to those guys normally, but they were a breed of themselves. I mean, they didn't have the spit and polish side of the Navy, and they were more free and easy, and they could talk with the men, you know. Some of the officers were too straight-laced. You couldn't do anything with them.
So that was a little later on, but what did you guys do after you sailed from Pearl Harbor to San Francisco?
Well, we came back and had 9 days leave. I went to Idaho. It was up there 2 days, and they said, get back to the ship. So I just tried to turn around and come back. I had to borrow $80 from my dad for a flight to get back to ship, and I just barely made it. You know, there's no excuse for missing ship.
Well, you mentioned going back home to Idaho, and that makes me wonder, had your parents been concerned that you may have been killed when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
It was real slow on notifying on ships that were damaged or anything. And then it finally got to where they wouldn't list it at all, because the minute you listed a ship as damaged, they'd get in the paper, and the Japanese knew exactly where they were. They plotted all of them. So that's why they didn't tell. But my parents, my mother thought I was just going AWOL anyway. She there wasn't anybody missing me.
So you just barely make it back to your ship, and then what?
Well, I got back to ship. We went aboard, and the first thing we were doing was going down to San Diego to get some radar stuff. We didn't even know what a radar was, really, at that time. They were just out putting them up. We went down there and got that, and then we were back out to sea, and we joined the first convoy. We were the, might say, the weapon and the ears for the convoy that was going back, because we had real fine sonar gear. You know, we could pick submarines up quicker than a destroyer could. We had real good gear on there. Gathered a whole slew of ships and headed for Melbourne. And the minute we got back from there, they put us on forced draft speed, and we were going to Alaska up there for the Battle of Midway. We thought we were going to Battle of Midway. We ended up being up on the north end of it, protecting Kodiak, Alaska. They didn't want the Japanese to come into Kodiak, because that was our main fuel station for all of our planes and ships in that area was Kodiak.
That's when you lost your friend Morrison, was up there in the Aleutians?
Yeah, they fly out. SOCs, search observation craft, were a new thing then, because they could fly up and, like, you could see a whale or whatever it was. They got up there, they could spot submarines. They could look down in the water and see them, and we know right where to go to get them. And we knocked off they got a whole bunch of submarines that way by flying up high. Well, he was out on one of those missions, and he stayed out too long or whatever it was, and the weather was really, you know, it would be like all bright sun like this, and then all of a sudden everything is fogged up to where you couldn't see. It could happen in a half a day or in an hour.
You know, I thought of something else I didn't ask you with regard to Pearl Harbor. I've heard a lot over the years from guys about how that made them feel. That, I mean, of course, the famous quote from Yamamoto was, "I fear we've awakened a sleeping giant." And I've seen the posters with the tattered flag and "Remember Pearl Harbor." Can you help us understand what the sentiment was among your fellow sailors after Japan carried out that surprise attack?
Yeah, just kill them any way that you could kill them. We had no thought of going home or anything else. There wasn't anybody in the Navy that thought of anything other than going to get in a Japanese. It didn't make any difference how you did it. And Halsey come along with a sign that used to have big billboards that said Lucky Strike cigarettes, Chester Hill cigarettes, and things like that. He took those and he put them out there on those islands and said, kill Japs, kill more Japs. And he had them all over the Pacific. That was more or less the logic. That's what we were out there for, and nobody tried to dress it up pretty or anything like that. We're just going to kill some Japs. They killed a lot of us. I never did feel like we got even. I still don't to this day, but it had to end somewhere. And the logic says that it was good that they ended it the way they did. But because a lot of you guys wouldn't be here either. If we'd had to go to war in Japan itself, it's just miserable.
So what about the day where your ship got torpedoed? Where were you guys, and how did that unfold?
We were protecting a landing area for the Marines to go into New Georgia Island. And the Japanese were on one side, and we were on the other. And we wanted to make sure that we did away with as many of them as we could. And we sank some, and I can tell you that we just sailed the ship right through clusters of guys hanging on to rafts or whatever they could hang on. I was aboard. Well, you look at that picture, there's two searchlights up there. We finally found out this most stupid thing we had during the World War was to have those searchlights. You know, that was carried over from World War One. You turn a searchlight on the Japanese Navy, and they'd fire right down, and they could range on it, and they'd hit. You give them a direct hit.
Here we are. We're over here. Fire away.
That's exactly what happened. So they finally took those away from us. But that's where I was when those things come in, was up there on the searchlight.
So how did you experience it? Did you feel what happened? Did you see something?
Not really. I mean, to me, I was kept wondering why we weren't shooting back. But the Japanese shot at us. In fact, as they hit one of the stacks, those searchlights were up there, and one of the rounds of something off of the Japanese tore one of our stacks. So I was pretty close to action there, but I don't know.
Well, and I think it's pretty close to be pushing an armed torpedo back out of your ship, too. I mean, that's pretty close. What does that feel like, by the way, when you don't know if that thing is...
You have to do what you have to do. That's basically what it was. I had a Marine buddy that lived out here pretty close to here. And I asked him that same question. When you're in one of those landing craft and you got 12 guys around you, how do you ever make yourself go? He says, well, you just all go together. And that's the way he explained it. And I think that's pretty much the way we were down there. We had a torpedo in there. We had to get rid of it. And you don't think, oh, my God, it's going to kill me or anything. We never had any thought other than getting rid of the torpedo.
And if they hadn't, we would not be having this conversation. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the hole that torpedo was pushed back out through, not to mention other photos of the USS Honolulu. More of 97-year-old Chuck Keene's World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Chuck Keene of Porterville, California. He and his late wife Judy counted two children, three grandchildren, and four great-grandchildren as those who would have never been born had Chuck not survived December 7th, 1941, and a few other perilous moments in World War II, like the early morning hours of July 13th, 1943 in the Solomon Islands, when a Japanese torpedo blew the entire bow off of his ship. You can see some photographic evidence at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. It's not every day you see anchor chains hanging down over a flat stump where the cruiser's bow used to be.
Well, when we were torpedoed, and you saw the picture of where the chains were hanging down the front of the ship like that, at the same time that we were hung up on that, they torpedoed the Honolulu from the stern, and the torpedo coming about 6 feet, 6 or 8 feet of it into the ship. If you imagine all the engine just a roaring away, but the anchors are hanging on the bottom, we're trying to get out of there. The bow's blowed off, we can't do anything. We got to go aft to get away from it, and the anchors are on the bottom. So we had to have the guy, our ship fitter, it was what they call him on there, go up and cut those lengths on the cable, had to cut them to where we could break loose from the anchors. We would have never got back to Tulagi. We were just firing away to get loose from that. But at the same time, what was happening with me was this torpedo went in the steering engine room, and our gasoline for all of the planes that we had on there was stored right next to it. And there's this torpedo in there back and forth like this. It didn't go off. The guys realized, a kid named Ornette, and I don't know some of the others, but they realized that every time it got level, they could shove it a little bit. And so they kept pushing on it to push it back out the hole. And the ship's roaring up and down trying to go, you know, but it can't go because of the anchors. But it seemed like it all worked together. It gave us just enough time to get that blame thing out of the rear of the ship before we took off, you know. And so this guy, and the last thing is he grabbed a hold of the bulkhead up above like that and put his stocking feet on it and shoved it, and it finally went out the hole and didn't explode. So we were very lucky that the two things happened at the same time. One, if the anchors hadn't hung up, we'd have probably been blown to no God knows where. But with the anchors hung up that way, we couldn't go. You know, you can't go with two anchors hanging down. And so we had that. We pushed that torpedo out, and then at the same time, that guy cut those cables up there, and the anchors fell, and then we were able to. We backed into, you might say, 200 miles down to Tulagi.
Your ship is in really bad shape. It's, you know, torn to pieces. Was there some concern that while you guys are going slowly back to Tulagi that you might get hit again?
Well, torpedo-wise, it's possible. We had also a real good thing. Every plane that they had in the country around there, I saw, I guess 40 of our planes up in the air over us going back, and that was a real good feeling that we had aircraft. I stayed with it till we shipped from there. It's almost 2,500 miles back to Pearl, and I always felt like they just tried pulling us along there like a baited duck or something for the Japanese submarines to get, because they sent us without any escort, doing 12 knots. But we got in, you know, and we had several alarms along the way, but the way they shipped us, I guess the Japanese just didn't think we'd be in that water. We sailed it into Pearl. I was detached there at Pearl and put them on the receiving ship to go catch another ship. And while we were waiting to catch the other ship, I heard that, they was going to send the Honolulu on to San Francisco. And I went back and I said, hey, how come we bought it this far? How come we can't ride the rest of the way? And so they let us.
So now they put you on a brand new ship, a destroyer escort, the yeah. John C. Butler. And what about your duties on that ship?
My duties on that is a head electrician, showing a lot of guys that have never been around a fuse or a wire or electric current or anything, to show them you can touch this, but you can't touch that. The basics of how to take care of the electrical stuff was that, and I had my hands full. There's a little side story on that, too. They shipped us a chief petty officer, and he was from the West Virginia. You know, it was done away with. So he was from West Virginia looking for, so they shoved him aboard our destroyer escort. You come on there, and now all they had on there was DC current, you know, like your batteries and so forth like that. And up to 120 volts, you can just reach up there and pull a fuse out or whatever. It's not going to do anything unless you short the terminals. It won't shock you. But he came on there, and I said, you can't put your hand in there. This is AC. He said, AC, BC. He says, I don't care what it is. He says, I always change fuses this way. Reached his hand up there and just knocked him right back. And then he said, well, these over here, maybe I can work on the other. And I said, oh, no, that's 440.
He had a death wish, didn't he?
Yeah. But he got into the 220, and the minute he got into 220, he went up and asked for a transfer. So I was left with no chief, no first class, and I was a second-class electrician, and I took over that ship, and I sailed it through the war. We had some sub-runs, you know, like chasing submarines. I think we got one. No real way of confirmation, but there's a bunch of crap come up. They said we got one off of a little place called Manus. Do you ever see the picture of that dog that we had aboard, the John C. Butler?
I saw her, Nellie B., right? What's the story there? I saw a picture of you with the dog. What's the story with the dog?
Well, the chief founder was just a little tiny pup in Pearl Harbor, and he sneaked her aboard ship, and we were off Samoa on our way to be escort for a group of ships that were going into Australia. When we were on our way down there, all of a sudden she come aboard, you know, went to general quarters, and he had no way to hide her or anything like that. So there's a dog in the captain. He just wasn't the guy that wanted to drown her. You know, but what else can you do with a dog when you're in a convoy going, you know, and she wasn't supposed to be in there. So he let it go, and from then on, she was aboard. She was a member of our ship. The only dog in the Pacific aboard ship. She was a real companion for all of us, you know. She used to do a lot of things, like guys would be sitting up playing pinochle on the fantail or whatever it was, and the one guy had trained her to get him a cigarette. She'd do a camel. She said, "No, I want a camel." And she'd go back and put it back. And she knew the difference between the picture. She'd pick a cigarette out of a camel for him and bring it to him over there while he was gambling. Uh-huh. Little things like that. She's just sharp.
What'd y'all feed her on the ship?
She had everything that she wanted. She always had all the foods in the world. We naturally have food aboard ship would be a good fit for a dog. She had her own beer ration. Whenever we go ashore, they'd give her two beers. And she'd drink them. Didn't bother her at all. Fact is, I got in trouble with a communications officer, and he got ashore in time for dish out the beer, hand out the beer to the guy. He says, "Keen doesn't get it. His goes to the dog." He gave my beer to the dog, and they could do about it. That's the one guy that if I was ever going to do away with somebody, that was the one. What happened was he was talking about being an atheist, you know. "Oh, well, I'm an atheist. You know, there's no such a thing as a God." And all of these kids, you know, they had the Catholics and Methodists, and a lot of kids, they really hung on to the religion. I didn't hang tight because my family was kicked out of the Mormon church and out of the Lutheran church. So I didn't have very close ties when I went in. But anyway, he's our authority. He says, "Oh, there's no God. There's nobody up there." And just the way he said it, he was sort of strutting and bragging about it. And I said, "Do you go to the academy?" "Yes, I went to the academy." And I said, "Well, what did you say for the oath?" He looked at me for a minute. I said, "What did you say for the oath?" He says, "Well, it's so help me God." I said, "So you're a liar." That did me in. We were done from then on, you know. They get ready, load a ship, you know, for a Liberty Party. Everybody, you get everybody on there, and then he'd take off and leave me aboard ship. Not anything anybody could do about it. Head of personnel. It was just hateful things like that he did.
Yeah, I was looking at that picture of Nellie B. and imagining what it would be like. I see all those young sailors' faces and this little dog down there. How much of a difference did that make? What did having a dog aboard ship do for you guys mentally or emotionally?
We were able to relax, and everybody, it's just a little moment, like I was telling you about the dog picking up the cigarette for the guy, and her battle station was the radio shack, and which was up one deck, and those steps, you know, they're not straight up, but they're metal and they were hard to get up. She had a time with it for a while. The guys had to help her. She finally got to where, boom, 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 she'd go right up those things. And a couple of times she'd slip and fall through. And after, but she knew port from starboard, you know. In other words, port side, you're going forward. And yeah. Starboard, you go aft. Better well not try to go the other way or somebody will run over you. But she knew I would be back there. They sent general quarters back here on Fanny. Zip. She'd be over there in the line, and up there she'd go up there and duck down on the place underneath where the type board was for the radio.
Yeah.
She'd sit down underneath there. That was her station. She knew where she had to go whenever that alarm went. Well, she knew just where she'd go.
Did she ever get any promotions?
No, we kept her out of the officers' quarters as much as we had. We didn't want her to get contaminated.
And what about when the war was over? What happened to Nellie B?
Nellie B went with John C. Stemple, chief radio guy. They got off in Long Beach, and I never saw him again. But I was there when he left the ship.
Well, and there was a lot you had to endure between that. Let's talk about the Battle of Leyte Gulf and a piece of it, the battle off Samar, that was the longest, most intense naval engagement maybe ever. Your ship was involved in that?
Yes, but that was the four carriers and nine destroyer escorts and destroyers. And we had, that was what we had. And the Japanese had a battleship and two cruisers. And those battleships could make 30 knots. The most speed we could make as a destroyer escort was 23. So you can see where we fast got in trouble there. And the Admiral kept sending guys in. We had smoke in our generators that we kept smoke in front of the carrier so that they couldn't see him. And that's what we were doing. This kid picture that Joe Lonnie was a guy that was here. Twice he saved our necks. And out there on that, he run his smoke as long to just where he got by and he knew that it was covering the ship. He'd cut it off and then go back around and run it again. Well, some of the guys just left their smoke on. Well, they'd run out. The minute you run out of smoke, they said you're in to try to shoot down a battleship. We kept going back and forth, and at the last, we figured we were going to be the next one. And all of the last minute, that guy, that Japanese admiral, decided he'd better get out of there for the carriers. He thought the planes were coming back in, and they were from our escort carriers, and he thought they were coming from Halsey's main force, so he wanted to get them out of there, get his ships out of there, and he didn't make it. They got him anyway, but he tried to go out through what they call the Surigao Straits.
Yeah.
We lost three destroyers, two destroyer escorts. We lost five. We lost two carriers. We saved two. And that saving those carriers were the most vital thing that we could do to give us air support for the battle at Leyte. You know, they call those planes in for the Marines and the guys on Leyte.
And when you say you saved them because of your smoke screens and because of your guns firing at enemy planes?
Joe Lonnie, with the smoke, running the smoke back and forth like that, we were the last one to have smoke. And we made one trip like that, and we were getting ready to go around one more when they called it off. And we still had a little bit of smoke left. Not much, but some. This guy, Joe Lonnie, he was just a sharp kid. He knew what he was doing with the equipment he had. Who would ever think that running a smoke generator would be part of a war? But it was. It was a vital part there because they couldn't range as long as they couldn't see the ships. It was like a cloud in there between them. Yeah.
Well, and you said, too, before when you showed me his photo, he saved your life. Where was that, and what did he do to save your life?
They invaded Okinawa, and we were up there on picket duty north of Okinawa. We were between there and Kyushu. Different ships had been there. Some only lasted 6 hours and some a day, but we were in our third day, and I think that's why we got the presidential unit citation, was because we stayed up there almost 3 days, and we shot down six of those kamikazes, and one of them was shot down was Joe Lonnie. He got into the fantail, the one place you can't shoot a gun is right over the fantail. You know, they block them off so you can do there. We broke the stops on ours so our guns could go across, but this Japanese was coming right up the fantail, right up through the rear end of the ship, and they don't figure on dropping a bomb or anything. They're gonna hit you,
right.
The ship, the kamikazes. That's what they did, and so he was on his way, and Joe killed him, pulled the gun up, blew him up, and then the plane went off to hit alongside the ship. I didn't see it. I was over on the other side, but when he hit him, it just plane turned off and went into the water.
So if he hadn't gotten them at that point, it would have hit the ship and there would have been an explosion and you might not be here.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be here because we had all of our gas and everything like that on the back, and the ammunition is loaded aft on those destroyer escorts. Everything was loaded back there in the back. He saved our neck. That was it.
So that's an explosion that didn't happen, but there was another one later that did, and you told me a little bit about what happened to you there.
We brought John C. Butler back into the Todd Shipyards for repairs, supervisor for the shipyard electrician. He said we reported that we had a power failure aboard the ship. We had two power cables, one that you could use all the time, and then a spare one. Well, coming back from Saipan, we were in that last big, horrible typhoon, whatever they want to call them out there. It just practically wiped everything out. It killed a lot of guys on Buckner Bay and even our B-29s on Tinian. I mean, it was just a wrecking storm. The Japanese wasn't it. It was just the weather. And it caught us, you know, like this, back and forth. One time I could see it missed going in the stack, looked about that much. If it hit in the stacks, we'd have blowed up. But we survived that.
And you're saying the waves were so big, yeah, they almost came over and blew water into the stack.
The ship was going down, you know. The big waves this way, and you go right down, like the ship would be tipped almost like a cork. It was huge. But in so doing that, all of a sudden, wham, our power went out, and we had no power to the guns on one side of the ship. It is all dead. You just don't have anything. And it was down inside the runs where those heavy cables went. So when we hit Long Beach, I reported that the C phase was out on the power, which is what it was. I had A, you have A, B, and C phase. Well, I had A, B, and BC, but no AC. That makes any sense to me. The power travels three ways, and two were all right, and one was dead. And that's what I reported. He said, "There isn't anything wrong with this. There isn't anything wrong with this." And I said, "No, look." I said, "There's three ways that power could get there, and I said A, B, and C, A, and B, C." And I said, "There isn't anything on the AC." And I reached up and took a wiggy. I don't really, it's a test equipment. Put it on there. I said, "Look." And I took it like that and put it on one and went across, and it arced. And when it went across, that there's no fuse. You know, it was so moist in there that it just exploded. It jumped from one terminal over to the other, and the ship was locked into the power grid on the dock, so there's no fuse or any way to blow it off. It just burnt the daylights out of it and knocked me out right with it. That's the way I got hurt. I woke up with a pull motor on me. That's what did it. I practically electrocuted me. I guess you'd say in all purposes I probably was electrocuted, but not to dead. But
knocked you unconscious?
Yeah, I was unconscious, and I went. I came to. I was on the ambulance going down the dock. They called Judy, and they called her, and said I was hurting. And when we got out and come out of the end of the dock, she got on there with me, and to go to the hospital. But my eyes were burned, and I couldn't see for 3 days. Everything on my face was burned, the nose, and I didn't know that I was going to be able to see. But they did something that they had never done before. They sprayed my ears and my eyes with penicillin. They sprayed it on me, and I don't know if they ever have a treatment like that anymore or not. But, I mean, my ears come out of it, and my eyes, just some miracle or some way or other, I was able to see. It didn't burn my eyes out, but that's where I, talking about that morphine, I gave the guys at the start of the war, I said, what a way to have to end it, you know, but I just screaming for morphine to give me some, because my eyes just felt like there's somebody just digging in my eyes. They gave me a shot of morphine, and it settled down, and then I gradually got better from there.
Well, I'm sure there are many more stories we could tell, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us that story. When I listen and I hear how close things were for you at Pearl Harbor, how close they were on the Honolulu when the bow of your ship is taken off and then you're pushing a torpedo back through the hull, the explosion later that could have killed you, that did knock you unconscious, the interesting way that you met your wife of how many years?
73. We were married 73 years.
And they said it wouldn't last.
It didn't.
73 is pretty impressive, and I know you miss her. But when you think about all those factors, the way all those things worked out, you told me about your conversation with the atheist earlier, that you had a good comeback for him about the oath at Annapolis. But how do you explain all of that now? Do you think someone was orchestrating things on your behalf, or are you just lucky? How do you explain it?
I believe in God. I don't know what his purpose is, and I think he's got some guidance in my life. He must have, or I wouldn't still be here. That's the way I have. I have a faith that he left me alive for a reason, and I draw some comfort for that. I'm glad for my family. That's about all I can say is I worry about the world things, but you and I aren't going to be able to do anything about them unless you vote.
You know, out of the more than 16 million Americans who served in World War II, they say now there are fewer than 400,000 of them left. When we talk about Pearl Harbor survivors, that number is a lot, lot lower. So you're one of the last ones who can tell us that story, who was there, who experienced it. What do you think is the most important thing for the rest of us to understand and remember about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
Be prepared for anything, you know. Have a defense for where you are and what you're doing. Remind yourself that this is the only country in the world with this type of a government. And that may sound like flag waving, but that's actually the way that I feel.
What are you most thankful for and what are you most proud of?
Most thankful for my wife and my life, and most proud of is that I'm still here.
And ready to commemorate the 78th anniversary of the day that changed his life and changed the world. You can tell how clear Chuck's memories are, even at age 97, and there was actually quite a bit more to our conversation that we couldn't squeeze into our radio time. You can hear all of that in the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a few short videos of Chuck, including one about a special project his great-granddaughter is taking on to be a blessing to Chuck and his fellow veterans. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. Well, you mentioned Judy. I got to hear the story of how you two met.
I didn't have any date. We were down in Miami Beach.
And this is while the war's still going on.
Yeah, the war's still going on. I was going down there for training for the John C. Butler. I'd already left the Honolulu, and was going down there for training at Miami Beach on AC Current. Well, I was one of the few that knew all about AC Current because I come off a cruiser. Right. At that time, better than half of the ships in the Navy were DC Current. They never had any AC. The guys never knew how to handle it or anything. It was a new thing to them. And so I was down there taking that training for that, and about 4 or 5 days into a kid from Wisconsin Said he needed me to go on a date with him. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, said I want to go with this girl, and she won't go unless her girlfriend goes, and I'm not going to go with two of them. So I went with him, and that's how I met my wife, was on there. And she brought her out, and this is the way it started. I was sort of a nasty guy. But she came out, and she had on a real teal blue dress, you know, and sort of a, not cotton, but a dent. And I said, is that a wool dress? I said, you can't wear that. I said, get it all over my uniform. She said, I don't plan getting anything on your uniform. But that's the way we met, and 2 months later we were married.
What was it that drew you to her so? What was the impression she made on you?
She was the first decent, clean, honest-looking gal that I met in the Navy. So many of them could cuss like a sailor, you know, and brutal things like that these gals haven't heard me say before, but the guys would bet on whether their bra straps were clean, and the guys reach up and jerk the bra strap, and we bet $5 on whether they had a clean bra on or not. And, yeah, that's what they bet on, all kind of things like that. And no respect for the women whatsoever. And Judy was the first one that I ever met that was an honest, clean-living gal. Mm-hmm. And plus the fact that she's a lot of fun. You know, she was so innocent that in itself, to me, was an experience. We were aboard the ship. There's a kid named Wissentainer, and he brought this band guy along with him. And a band, they had a harp on there or something, and...
A harp embroidered on their sleeve?
Yeah, on their sleeve. And she says, oh, what is that? And I just, that's not a thing. I said, well, they're angel strikers. I said, we have angel first, second, third class angels, and they're striking for angel. And old Wissentainer was laughing his off, and he told her that, and she never did forget it. But I just flipped it out, you know, like that, and there's no such a thing as an angel striker or anything like that.
But I understand, you know, you were trying to pull the wool over her eyes there, but I understand there was a secret she kept from you for a long time, huh?
She was in the MIT, or Military Intelligence Service, and she was in it all the time I was with her, and she was up to where she had guys watching her. You know, she had her own patrol. If there's anybody trying to get her, they would have taken her out or take them out, whatever it was. And she was a code person for military intelligence. She got up to where she interviewed. She was there for the head of Cuba, Bautista. He was the head of the government, and he was trying to get destroyers for us to furnish him destroyers for Cuba.
Right.
And we didn't trust him for anything, you know. But she was in that Central America section, and so she had to go in with the interview when they were interviewing him, and because this was all beginning for a lot of people, you know. But she took down everything that he said, which is what you hear these guys say now, that on this all this reporting, I took down this, I took notes on this. Well, that's what she did. She did all the time, but she never told me about it, and I never told her about that AEC. But the time because I couldn't tell her anything about what was on Guam. We both had 50-year pledges to you don't tell anybody for 50 years. I knew she was in there because I went to her headquarters in Miami Beach.
So you and Judy meet, and you get married 6 weeks later, and then you're shipping back out for the rest of the war.
Yeah.
Was there any concern on your part that you might not see her again?
No, well, not very much. I mean, I planned on seeing her, but I also at the same time had the idea that it might not. I mean, I think she thought a lot more about it than I did, because she did a lot of crying and I didn't, you know. It's a different time, you know. You just look like you're impervious. I think that's the way I felt, like nothing's going to stop me or anywhere I wanted to go, I could go. And I had that feeling all the way till that Battle of Samar. And I was married to her then. And I always felt like, well, wherever the water is, that's where I'm going. You know, I just got to go. And the Freeburg, this kid from Washington, and I, we did so many things that anytime we could get closer to where the action was, that's what we wanted to do. Till the Battle of Samar. And then all of a sudden, I thought of Linda being born and wanting to get home, you know, and then I was afraid. That's the first time in that whole war that I was afraid. It had to be a, and I had guys that are scared to death all the time they were in there. And I never was afraid until I realized that I might not get home. And then I got frightened. And then since then, when I'm older now and I can't take care of myself, some guy come up to the back door here or something, and I realized that I couldn't fight him off, and I become frightened. And that's the most hateful feeling to me in the world, is to be afraid. I was so lucky that I had the frame of mind that I had while I was out there. You know, I didn't say it brave, but I mean, you just didn't think of it that way. It's just something you had to do.
So you knew you had a pregnant wife who you needed to get home to, or else you may not meet your son or daughter. You didn't know what yet.
Didn't know whether it was a boy or girl. But I knew sometime during the time that I'd gone. I mean, I don't remember just when that we knew that she'd been born. That was sort of a unsettled time. I didn't know what it was going to do. You'd be out there for 6 years, and all of a sudden you're out, and 12 million guys. I come back here looking for work, and I always remember a guy, Poundstone, was an electrician. I went to him and asked for, he says, you're asking what 12 million other guys are. He says, you got a job? And I said, well, I just come out of the Navy. He says, my advice to you is to turn around and go back and rejoin while you can. He says, there's nothing here for you. That was my first welcoming to Porterville.
Well, what was it like to come back and see your wife again and meet your daughter for the first time?
Well, we had about a year and a half of just fun, just joyful as all could be. I can always remember the first time that I tried to give her egg, and it was too hot, and it burned her mouth. And her grand Judy and her mother liked to kill me. Yeah.
Hey, and you mentioned something a little bit ago that, you know, it was 50 years before you could talk about what was on Guam at the end of World War II. You want to talk about it now? You want to clue us in?
Well, I can tell you a little bit about it. Is the turkey eggs, you know, they take about a little longer. I think it's 28 days. A chicken takes 21, and they take a few more days. And they had eggs spaced on there to where they were fertilized eggs, and see what they would be like when if they were born. Well, they were born, they were just a head. You know, they never had any legs or anything like their mutations. It's a horrible looking thing, you know. It the head grew in the egg and nothing else. And then the other thing was, is they had little pups, cocker spaniel type dogs. I think they were little cocker spaniels, and they were born with no way to empty their bodies, no export.
So these were experiments that were taking place there?
In experiments that they had. We tried to do it with horses, but they did a miscalculation on that. They put them on the Saratoga, and that bomb was 6 miles up in the air or whatever it was, and it killed everything that they had on the Saratoga. They lost all of the experiments, the horses and everything. I remember, Saratoga was one that would, we'd come alongside the John C. Butler, and I think even maybe the Honolulu refueled from them once. We'd get refueled from their gas.
Right.
And doggone, what did I say?
Well, just to bring it all together, you're saying, so when they're doing atomic testing after the end of World War II, there were things that were placed in proximity to the blast to gauge the effect of the radiation on those living things?
Yeah, and the one that they did for the Saratoga It just showed how they could miscalculate. Everything on there was gone, and the Honolulu used to have teak wood decks, you know, gray and different color and everything like that. And we went up and looked at it, and it was just orange hulk. It all, everything had melted down, and the orange was the red lead. That's what they painted the, you know, they you put a primer on before you paint something, and that's what they called red lead. And so that was the color of the Saratoga before they, and it was so so radioactive that all they could do is take it out there, and it's sunk in the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean out there. It's a trace off of Kwajalein. Uh-huh. In that area, there's a trench out there somewhere.
So, did you witness some of those explosions?
I saw one, yeah, but not looking at it because they didn't. But it lit below the it's permeating it, coming clear down into the ship. You know, we knew when it went off. You know, that's all. That's the only one that I saw.
But then after that, they would take these things back to Guam and monitor them to see what happened?
Yeah, take everything as alive or and not necessarily alive, different types of material. They tried to find something that would shield against it. And radioactivity was just everywhere. And the island where they tried that, I don't know if you read that story of that island, but they took all the soil off from it three times. And see, those people, that's their homeland. That's their, like, wherever you were born. Yeah, and it's a little island, Anjibi and Aniwetok, and one of the others. Anjibi was one that I think that they took everything off from. And so they put the soil back and got it all straight and put the palm trees and everything up there. All of a sudden, people started getting that radioactivity. The people, they had it in the nails and the shoes and everything else. So they said they were different type of clothing and stuff like that, but it was in the soil. They just had to go back in. They bladed everything off of there completely down to nothing again, dumped that out there in that trench, and tried it again, and it was the same thing. There's no way. I guess it'll be 10,000 years before the radioactivity is out of that.
And what was the facility, the station at Guam called that you were working at then?
NAMRU 2.
NAMRU 2.
Naval Atomic Research Unit number 2. I hope they've got it shut down, is what I hope. Because that is one way we can't go. I mean, if whatever his name is decides to go that way, well, he's going to take us all with him because there's no way. I heard talks, you know, this is part of the discussion that we had before I left the program, is they were setting these underneath the ocean. And we had this one scientist says, no, you don't want to do that. If you get fusion started with the sodium, it's going to burn. It'll burn the oxygen. It'll steal all the oxygen out. And the only thing to be left is chlorine gas. And that's where you think you've got clouds now, it'll just be chlorine gas over the whole peninsula. And they didn't believe him. You know, but the possibility is still there. And sodium, and so finally the last guys that tried to test anything was the French. And we went to them and explained what we thought could happen, and they backed out. You know, they backed out of testing. So nobody tests underwater. And that's this kooky guy from North Korea. He'll try it.
Well, and what did you do there at NAMRU 2?
I was an electrician and over all of the power distribution and making sure that they have dual power to all of the areas that were, I don't know what they call them, critical areas. I had to have two sources of power to everything. And that's all the time I was there, that's what I was doing, was building parallel power systems and trying to calculate it to where if one hits, the other will still be there. You know, I did a lot of that. That's,
how much radioactivity do you think you were exposed to?
Well, as much as those guys at Chernobyl. I mean, they what was our station that we had? 3 Mile Island, is that it? Yeah. I think we probably got pretty close to that. Well, I can tell you about a story that aboard the John C. Butler that was funny, humorous.
All right.
Yeah, after our exposure to the Japanese, and we shot the six down, and our radar and everything was blown off. They said, well, okay, you can come back. You're no good to us out there. We come back to Sakishima, which is a little island off of Okinawa. And while we're in there, here come a message from Admiral Halsey well done. He issued a well done to the ship and said he wanted to come aboard. Well, you know, to have the admiral for the whole cockeyed fleet come aboard a little old penny destroyer escort, which was something else. And so the captain was dashing around there trying to get your best shoes, get your uniforms. Well, some of us had different thing, and he had to show that picture.
This is what their uniforms were looking like.
That was our uniforms.
Yeah.
That was our uniforms, the way we ran aboard ship. Okay. And so we had to get into our dress blues or whatever uniform that we could, dungarees and a shirt, something. And this gunner's mate worked on the guns. And they have an oil in there that softens leather.
Right.
Pretty soon his toes were sticking out through his shoes. And he used all his shoes up, you know. Yeah, there's not that many size. He wore a big shoe, size 13. So everything he had, he'd tie them on. And with his socks, his toes were flopping out through the ends of them. You know? And so he said he couldn't get shoes. And so the captain said, okay, then send the... they wanted to have him. He was in charge of that division, and they wanted to have him at least reportable.
Since they shot down all the Japanese planes, they wanted him to meet the admiral.
Yeah, that is it.
Uh-huh.
And when the captain told him that he could go over to the supply ship to get some shoes, he went over there and he said size 13. They brought him out and they had two left shoes. No right. They were both left. That's all you got? He says, I'll take them. So he came back aboard ship, you know, put them on, looked like he was turning the corner. And he got dressed up the best he could, and I was the CIK, and he was two letters down from me, one way or the other. And marching along there, and the Halsey come by and says, well done, son, you know, speaking to some guys and others, he wasn't, but just we were all at parade rest for him, and he walked down there to him, and all of a sudden he backed up a step, and he says, what the hell happened to you? And he's sitting there, you know, in tension, and his feet turned like this. He's looking this way, and his feet turned that way. And Halsey says, what the hell happened to you? And he says, all I could get, sir. And I saw Halsey smile. That's the only time.
That's great.